So there is a climate crisis. Scientists agree we have about a decade to cut emissions and reverse this plummeting rush to famine, flooding, refugees. School children have taken to the streets. Jane Fonda just got arrested at a protest. Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and Senator Ed Markey proposed a Green New Deal. But Thomas Donahue, chief executive of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, called it a Trojan horse for socialism, a government takeover of business. And on the darkest end of the spectrum of climate science denial, the Christchurch killer who murdered 50 at a mosque called himself an eco-fascist, and Anders Breivik, who slaughtered 70 in Norway, called action against climate change enviro-communism, the new redistribution of wealth. So how do you address doubt about climate change and fast? Because, as Naomi Klein writes, we're not just facing rising seas, but rising hate. She is the journalist and activist who's compiled her essays on the topic and her new thoughts in her new book, On Fire, The Burning Case for a Green New Deal. And Naomi Klein joins us now. Naomi, way back in 2011, you went to a conference on climate change at the Disbelieving Heartland Institute. Start there.
I think that there's a bit of a misconception about the climate change denial movement, that it's sort of being driven by some rogue scientists who disagree with their peers. But when you go to these gatherings, you realize that it's being driven by free market think tanks like the Heritage Foundation, the Heartland Institute, the Center for American Enterprise. The ideological project that these think tanks represent, because they've been championing deregulation of corporations, a tiny state that you could drown in a bathtub, low taxes for the wealthy, all of that falls apart in the face of this collective crisis that requires basically breaking every one of those rules.
Well, that's what you point out. I mean, again, we had Thomas Donahue, I mentioned, U.S. Chamber of Commerce, calling the Green New Deal a Trojan horse for socialism. You heard back in 2011 people saying climate change is a Trojan horse designed to abolish capitalism, replace it with some kind of eco-socialism. And you say you have an inconvenient truth for everybody. They're not entirely wrong. That, right, in fact, there is going to have to be that much of a sea change.
Right. The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which is the body that is tasked with advising governments on the latest climate science and what our collective carbon budget is, they came out with this now landmark report almost exactly a year ago, the one that told us that we had just 12 years to cut global emissions in half or face truly catastrophic climate unraveling. They said it is still possible for us to keep warming levels below 1.5 degrees Celsius, but it would require, and this is a quote, fundamental transformations of every aspect of society, our energy system, our transportation system, our agriculture system. And so that requires massive investments in the public sphere, exactly what these free market think tanks have been railing against for, some 50 years. It requires that we regulate corporations. It requires that we actually increase taxes on the wealthy, because this is going to be pretty expensive. So this is why they have been denying it all along. And we need to understand that if we do break these rules, then we can actually create millions of unionized, well-paying jobs. This economic system that they've been arguing for, this deregulated capitalism, actually is producing many crises, not just the climate crisis, but it's also creating a crisis of precarious work, of economic inequality. So there are all kinds of reasons why we should break these rules.
Well, first of all, to the claim that you are using the climate crisis to just advance socialism, it sounds like you and others who are behind this thinking are thinking the opposite. No, we're going to take advantage of what we know about what socialism can do to stop the climate crisis. It's kind of the reverse. But for people for whom that word is so frightening, and it is, and we see it playing out in the election this year, the difference between democratic socialism, which is some government involvement in your life, not complete government takeover of, let's say, all industry. If Bernie Sanders can't get that message out, how do you get that message out that there will be some private industry, that, it's not, we're not talking the Soviet Union? How do you do that?
No, we're talking about a significant shift in the balance between public and private. When we talk about a Green New Deal, we are not talking about abolishing the free market. We're talking about remembering a time when there were major investments in the public sphere in the face of a collective crisis. During the original New Deal, it was the worst crisis that capitalism had ever produced. And I would argue that climate change now is an even bigger crisis than that. Yeah. But it was also a time of great ecological disruption. You had the Dust Bowl, you had a crisis of deforestation. And so what FDR did was not a single policy to deal with the Great Depression. It was Social Security, unemployment insurance, breaking up the banks, introducing the Civilian Conservation Corps, which planted 2.3 billion trees. You had more than 10 million Americans directly employed in different government programs. And I think now, because we've ever since Reagan and Thatcher, we have been told that every time we try to do anything together, things go horribly wrong, that there is no such thing as society, or as Reagan said, the 9 most dangerous words in the English language are, I'm from the government and I'm here to help. We have forgotten that we actually can do big things together.
Well, you remind us how much many may have forgotten how much opposition there was to FDR. I mean, there was a senator from West Virginia who wrote to a colleague in 1933, this is despotism, this is tyranny, this is the annihilation of liberty. A former DuPont executive complained, now that the government was offering decent paying jobs, which is part of the New Deal, he wrote, 5 Negroes on my place in South Carolina refused work this spring, and a cook on my houseboat quit because the government was paying him $1 an hour as a painter.
You know, there was huge pushback to the original New Deal. And in fact, this whole think tank infrastructure, many of them were formulated explicitly to dismantle New Deal programs. So there's going to be opposition to these ideas, but I think the real shift that we're seeing now is generational. Among young people, there is a tremendous appetite for a response to the climate crisis that is on the scale of the crisis itself.
But you point out that it wasn't just wealthy on the right who were trying to stop FDR. It was people who might have sided with him saying, yeah, it's too much, too big, too quick, also reminiscent of today and the infighting on the left.
Well, look, I don't think that we just need a New Deal painted green. I think there were many problems with the original New Deal. The most obvious one are the people who were excluded from it. Many African-American workers were excluded. Domestic workers were excluded. Agricultural workers were excluded. And it was also far too centralized, in my opinion. And so one of the things that the messages that we have to get out is that we want a Green New Deal that's actually for everyone. And we want it to be much more decentralized. And that's one of the great things about renewable energy. You can have it wherever the wind blows and the sun shines. And so that lends itself to more decentralized ownership. So rather than having these big sort of bulky utilities, you can have community ownership. You know, the problem with the way we've been thinking about climate policy in a very unambitious way, in that very sort of carbon-focused way, like we just need a carbon tax, is that in an economy where so many people feel so stressed, so overburdened, those policies tend to be seen as just one more cost. And those policies are very easy to generate a backlash against. And we saw this in France with the Yellow Vest movement. And there was such strong opposition to Emmanuel Macron's carbon pricing.
He wanted to raise the price on gas so that people would drive less, but that ended up hurting the people who needed to drive the most. I mean, the very wealthy probably weren't driving themselves around. They're flying around.
And they got tax breaks from him. I mean, Emmanuel Macron has handed out tax breaks, much like Trump has, for the wealthy and for corporations, at the same time as he has attacked trade union rights and imposed economic austerity in many sectors.
Well, and I also don't want to make the mistake that we sometimes can. And Sarah Smarsh, the great writer from Kansas, points this out. We shouldn't assume that everybody in the heartland who's, you know, busy trying to figure out what they do when steel working goes or when their farm gets flooded is opposed to trying to avert climate change. She reminds us that a lot of the support for climate denial comes from very wealthy people who want to hold on to what they have.
Exactly, exactly. And the slogan of the Yellow Vest movement in France was, you care about the end of the world, we care about the end of the month. We need a response to the climate crisis that says everybody has a right to care about both and you don't have to choose. It is possible to have this kind of holistic approach. It won't generate the backlash, which is what makes it more practical.
Yeah. That's journalist and climate activist Naomi Klein. Her new book is On Fire, The Burning Case for a Green New Deal. Naomi, thank you so much.
It was such a pleasure speaking with you, Robin. Thank you.